Hello and welcome to the IntraFish podcast, where we bring you the week's most interesting and compelling seafood news. I'm Drew Cherry, editor-in-chief, and I'm joined today by a large cast of characters, including executive editor John Fiorillo, correspondent John Evans, and senior business reporter Rachel Sapin. So we've got a few stories we wanted to look at this week that kept us busy and have kind of driven some interesting conversation. First off, we're going to talk about the Peruvian anchovy fishery and the quota announcement. Now, Peruvian anchovy, it's one of the largest, if not the largest, single biomass of fish in the world, and it's incredibly important for the fish meal industry, ergo important for the fish feed production industry. And then, yes, you can guess where I'm going. It's also important for the aquaculture industry, where feed accounts for around 70% of its costs. So, John Evans, you were on top of breaking this news of the Peruvian quota, and then talked to some folks about the market impact. So, tell us what we know and what we can expect from this volume of fish meal in the market.
Yeah, just to start with, Drew, as you mentioned, it's the anchovy quota announcements are always highly anticipated. And for those who are not aware, Peru has two different main fishing zones. The by far the biggest is the one in north central waters, and that has two seasons, which start usually April, May, going into August. And then again, the second season in November, and it all spills over into the new year. So we can expect the fishing season to close as long as there's not too many juveniles around sometime, excuse me, in January. So, yes, I mean, this time around for the second season, there was a quota of 2 million metric tons compared with 2.78 million metric tons in the North Central Waters this time last year. You might find that surprising that it was 26% lower, but quite a few people were expecting it to be lower. Although, this was based on a biomass of 7 million metric tons. A few weeks ago, some people were expecting the biomass to be 10 million tons, 9 million tons, but those sort of expectations ebbed away. And one of the reasons, main reasons for that is the amount of juveniles in the water or waters, because it's divided, even that region is divided into subdivisions. But a juvenile is classed as less than 12 centimetres, and the quota cannot be fixed at more than 30% of the biomass. As you said, this is important for fish meal prices. We're not too sure what the impact's going to be exactly at the moment, although we can say that bids for material, the prime material, went up $50 straight away with the announcement. And but it's not just the normal factors such as supply and demand which can affect the price this time around, as we've seen and we've spoke about quite frequently recently. The global container shipping crisis is having an impact, and some shipping companies are reluctant to carry fish meal, which is considered a dangerous cargo. Not so much because of that, because they can get more lucrative business transporting minerals.
Right. So, I mean, that's as with everything we're writing about nowadays, the shipping industry and the crisis there, obviously having some pressure on the, adding some pressure to the situation. John, talk a little bit about so the fluctuations in the Peruvian biomass and season to season. I mean, it can go pretty dramatically up or down. The seasons can be can have temporary closures. Can you just give a little bit of background about some of how that process works?
Yeah, I mean, last year, for example, we had two seasons exactly the same, 2.78 million metric tons. As we've seen this time around, it's down And it, as you say, it depends on the percentage of juveniles in the water. You can say, though, a month from now, a juvenile fish, which is 10.5 centimetres, may have grown to the correct size. They can carry on fishing it, and it may be that they take the bulk of the catches in December and January, possibly. So yes.
I mean, so it's, yeah, the quota itself is not, it's not a lock, correct? I mean, that's, I guess that's part of the key point is Peru does actually do a pretty, they're fairly on top of their closures when they get concerned. But certainly, a quota is not, ultimately guaranteeing a catch.
No, that's right. And, last January 2020, suddenly, because of the amount of juveniles in the water, they can't remember the precise figure off the top of my head, but it was a high quota, and they cut it short by a large percentage. I think it was 50% or something, or maybe even more than that. So yeah, they've got a track record of analysts in the market. They do tend to say that the stock is managed well these days. And part of that managing it well is, shutting down fishing if they have to.
Right. And we have, of course, El Nino and La Nina playing a role as well in these seasonal fluctuations.
Yeah, topical issues at the moment with climate change and the COP26 summit. And, the La Nina effect can affect the growth of fish and how they're dispersed as well. So, yeah, they're all factors that play into that. It's not a straightforward, it's not an exact science, fishing for anchovy, or possibly for any other species, particularly pelagics. So, yes.
Well, that's a fantastic segue into our next topic, which is Bristol Bay salmon in Alaska. It's the most valuable wild salmon run on the face of the planet. And it turns out it's going to get even more valuable if fishery scientists are correct. John Fiorillo, why don't you tell us a bit about what the University of Washington is projecting for this coming season in the Bristol Bay sockeye salmon catch, and what you think that's going to mean with a number that big.
Yeah, the University of Washington's Fisheries Research Institute released its 2022 forecast for the Bay. And it's one that's watched intently because it's been done for a very long time and tends to be extremely accurate. So what this forecast is calling for right now is a total run of 70 over 71 million sockeye returning to the bay, which would lead to a commercial harvest of roughly 52 million sockeye. So that's a lot of fish. The run estimate is 38% higher than the recent 10-year average and 60% higher than the 20-year average. So you can deduce from that there is potentially going to be lots of fish in the market, which is great because salmon consumption in the United States right now is off the charts, represents roughly 40% of all fresh seafood sold at retail. And that includes farm salmon as well, but the point being that salmon consumption, especially since the pandemic, has really exploded. So the timing could not be perfect, one would think.
Yeah, it's the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's forecast was not too far off of that, and between the two of them, it's as you said, John, pretty likely that they're going to end up around that level. They are remarkably, remarkably accurate. And we'll talk about fisheries management in a second. But just from the market perspective, there's been so much more fresh sockeye coming onto the domestic market, so much more effort to bring refresh sockeye into the domestic market. And it's really pressured Chilean coho prices in Japan, which compete now directly with the wild sockeye salmon from Bristol Bay. So just on the market side, tell us a bit, John. I mean, we've had some companies much more aggressively pushing their domestic product into the market, but just over the past couple of years, just tell us about how, what that change has meant on the U.S. market with more of that product coming into the domestic market.
Well, I mean, a lot of it is fallout from COVID, and when people no longer could run to the restaurant to get seafood options, they had to learn how to cook it at home. And, you know, I don't know about you, but fewer fish are easier to cook at home than salmon. And I think people discovered that. And, you know, there's so much you can do with it. The flavor's relatively mild, which is good for Americans. And, yeah, and it's taken off. And there's a lot more promotion of it in retail these days than maybe in the past. And it's just, you know, these are really good times for selling salmon.
We had a record-breaking season already at the end of the season when regulators tallied it all up. This season smashed records, and Rachel, you play point on tracking wild salmon for us. So, tell us a bit about just looking back at 2021. It was already we have a really fantastic season behind us.
Yeah, 2021 was a record year for Bristol Bay. The sockeye salmon run was the largest on record at 63.2 million. So they also harvested fish that were worth $361 million, over 57 million fish. So 2022, it's going to be interesting to see if it can break those records because, yeah, 2021 was a tremendous year. Bristol Bay just keeps seeing these record runs. And I was actually talking with Michael Jackson, the president of the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association. He's the board president. And he was saying the news is exciting, but it's also, you know, it's a little, it has everyone on their toes a little bit just because that is so many fish coming in every year. He's kind of saying that in recent years, the Bristol Bay runs are turning into these mega sockeye runs that are kind of part of these super systems in the Bristol Bay River system. So it's going to be interesting to see how processors deal with that, because I know in recent years they've had several days in a row during the peak of the season, which is usually in July, where they're processing millions of fish a day, and they actually they've had to put fishermen on limits in recent years just because it's so much fish coming in.
Yeah, and it comes in, it's such a narrow amount of time. Like you said, you can get, you know, so much fish going through those factories. And you know, part of this too, there's an asterisk on all this high volume as well, which is there has been smaller and smaller sizes of fish, and also there's no doubt, and Rachel, you've written about this as well. There's no doubt climate change is playing a role in. I mean, there's you think about climate change as having a deleterious effect on fisheries. And in some ways that's true, but then in other ways you are going to see these big changes in volumes of fish in different places, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The fish have been smaller in recent years, and the runs have just gotten larger. And scientists are still kind of trying to figure out what's going on with that. It certainly seems like it's related to some warming water temperatures. But again, we're kind of living through climate change, so we're still figuring out how that's working together.
Right. So you mentioned Michael Jackson, and actually he submitted a guest commentary to us this week. And very interesting, because oftentimes we focus on the market side of things. Of course, you know, we're a business publication, but when you look at these large runs, they don't just happen magically. There is a lot of work that goes into figuring out this really complicated fisheries behavior of wild salmon, especially in Bristol Bay. And Jackson kind of pointed out, he went up there. Jackson's a fisherman as well in Bristol Bay, but he went up to one of the fisheries camps way up on the lake system where the fish go up to spawn, and he observed firsthand some of the fisheries management practices and a lot of the work that gets done to try to figure all of this out. And it is extremely complex. You have to think about the amount of fish running up and that it's all coming in such a short period of time, as I mentioned. So fisheries managers have to gauge how much of the fish to let go past fishermen upriver, which is called escapement. And when to let that amount, when to open the fishery to let those fish go up, when to close it down. And so they face an intense amount of political pressure as well from fishermen to, you know, to open it up more because they're seeing fish. And then on the other hand, they're trying to figure out how to make sure, you know, when they should close the fishery. So it's really a remarkable group of people that manage those fisheries. And this, what I found interesting about what Jackson wrote about was that, you know, the system of management in Alaska and in Bristol Bay in particular, that's been in place. This sort of very science-based management has been in place since, you know, almost the early 1900s. The first, the University of Washington in particular, they have a fisheries research institute that that does a lot of work there, along with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game biologists and researchers. But the decline in the fisheries runs from the early 1900s, from about 1919 to the mid-1940s, really had people concerned. And it's interesting because we think of kind of modern fisheries management as something that hasn't been around that long. You don't think of people actually caring about fisheries management that far back, but of course they did. In particular, there's commercial interests that need those fish to process and make a living. So the runs declined from 22 million fish to 10 million fish from 1919 and 19 to the 1940s, as I said. And fishermen and company and fishing companies were very concerned and called on researchers from the University of Washington to do some work to figure out what was going on and how to better manage the fishery. So the Alaska Salmon Program was created. And the whole goal of it was to help rebuild those runs. So, I mean, that is incredible that back at that time, they were setting up research camps to try to understand this complicated anadromous behavior of fish. Of the sockeye salmon, they go out, they're spawned in freshwater in the rivers. They go out into the ocean and saltwater and do their thing in the ocean. And then when they come to spawn again and die, they go up into freshwater. So figuring out that whole process, how they have done it over the years is absolutely remarable. And Jackson really, I think, did a good job kind of highlighting the work that gets done by the University of Washington. It's led by Ray Hilborn, who's a very well-known a fishery scientist around the world, not just in the University of Washington. But, we don't often write about that. We don't often highlight that. And I thought he did a really good job kind of tipping the hat to the research that gets done to keep these runs strong. So yeah, good some good news about resources, and oftentimes we're not writing about good news on the size of fisheries resources, especially in Alaska. There's been closures of the crab fishery. There's been problems with the Pacific cod resource in the Gulf of Alaska. So this is some really good news.
I hope everybody heard those numbers, because the decline that you spoke of in the 40s was a run shrinking down to 10 million sockeye. That's a lot of fish, you know, by anybody's standard. But the run projected for next year is 71 million. The gap between that is obvious and large, right? I think the guest column by Jackson was incredible in the sense that it highlighted the work these guys do, like you mentioned. I mean, yes, they're supported by computer models these days and things, but they are still tramping out into no man's land in Alaska, where there are bears and bugs and everything else, and doing field work that is critical to feeding those computer models and spitting out these forecasts, which are amazingly accurate. I mean, we are trying to calculate how many salmon that are now halfway to Japan in the middle of the Pacific will be coming back to, five river systems, the Nakwijak, the Igigik, the Ugashik, the Nushigak, and the Togiak. I mean, it's mind-boggling to me, and I'll stop, but bravo to fishery scientists here and around the world.
There we go. It's a nice toast that we can give on Friday to the fisheries researchers around the world. So the unsung heroes. Great. Let's move on to salmon farming, and let's talk a little bit about what's been happening in Canada. It's results season, so all the salmon farming companies have put out how they did in the third quarter. No surprise, most did quite well. The demand for farmed salmon is extremely high across the world, and it's continuing to climb. It's not going to decline by any sort of metric that we've seen. So it was all in all a good third quarter. However, mixed third quarter for salmon farmers operating in Canada. The largest Norwegian companies are operating there, as well as Canadian giant Cook Aquaculture. So, Rachel, tell us a little bit about the latest in Canada. There were some challenges in the BC region, but the real action, the interesting things, I guess, over the course of the last couple of weeks has been Eastern Canada. Tell us about Moovy. They have struggled and had several incidents that have been challenging for them, including climate change related things over the past year or so. But tell us about their operations in Newfoundland. They are rethinking some of their ambitions there.
Yeah, Moovy recently announced in its third quarter earnings that it's going to hold back on growing in the Newfoundland area. It said recently that a low oxygen incident at its Canada East operations negatively impacted its cost and price achievement by $5 million. It lost about $6.5 million US dollars during the quarter from that. So they're just having issues with lower dissolved oxygen levels over there. They're getting in the summer high water temperatures and plankton. And that's really impacting Moovy's Canada East operations. So they are just kind of, for now, going to kind of reduce plans to expand in Newfoundland. It reduces the company's overall planning production for Canada by about 6,000 metric tons. So it's a pretty big kind of step back for the company. They really, in recent years, have been pretty enthusiastic about growing in Canada, but they've seen a lot of financial setbacks also during that time.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is I remember just a few years ago when it's been clear that British Columbia, for a long, long time, been clear that British Columbia is not going to be the place to grow for salmon farming. There's just a lot of opposition from First Nations groups and from the community. You know, it's just clear that, and it's gotten more clear of late, and you've written a lot about that. But Eastern Canada has been sort of hailed as the new frontier, and a lot of companies have begun expansion there. Cook's been there a long, long time, but Grieg has been expanding there. Movie's been expanding there as well, of course. Cermak attempted to expand there, and they ran into some headwinds. So much so that they scrapped their plans for a major operation there. Now, interesting story that you are tracking right now. Now Cook is facing some First Nations criticism, and they're not really used to dealing with that.
Yeah, Cook is kind of getting some feedback about wanting to expand one of its lease boundaries in Nova Scotia, where it operates in the Rattling Beach area of Nova Scotia. It's part of its Kelly Cove Atlantic Salmon Farming Division. They have an application before a newly created Nova Scotia Aquaculture Review Board that is a substantial increase for the company if it gets approved. They applied for a 69-acre site to hold 20 cages that can hold 660,000 salmon. And the original lease boundary there was for 4 cages and 120,000 salmon. So it could be a big change for Cook in terms of production. At this point, the company, though, is saying that they're only requesting a boundary change for a farm. They have no plans to increase production at that site, and they are doing so that all of their equipment is within the boundaries they have applied for, because I guess apparently they have been previously operating some equipment outside of those boundaries. That's kind of a topic of contention for some of the opposition groups, which, as you mentioned before, Drew, some of those opposition groups in Nova Scotia, a lot of environmental organizations and fishermen opposed to the company also were very adamant about Cermak not expanding in the area. And as you mentioned before, Cermak isn't expanding in Nova Scotia or if in the Atlantic Canada at this point. Pretty much what's going on is also the First Nations in that province, the Mi'kmaq, submitted a letter to the Department of Fisheries and Aquaculture in Newfoundland, in Nova Scotia, explaining that they really feel that Cook is treading on their territorial rights, on their Aboriginal rights with its operation, with wanting to expand its lease. And so far, they haven't been consulted with by the Canadian government, because the Canadian government says Cook is just looking to expand its lease boundaries at this point. It's not looking to harvest more fish. So it's kind of it's going to be interesting to see what happens for Cook with that application.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll keep on top of that. So folks, we'll wrap it up there. Just a reminder, IntraFish.com is our home, and that's where you can find us 24/7 writing about the seafood industry and all of the flood of news that comes across the transom, so to speak, in a given week. And there is a lot of it. So you can sign up for newsletters there if you want us to be right there in your inbox. And subscribers, of course, can sign up for new alerts, which are fantastic. You can really customize the news that you want to get about the topics that are important to you. In addition, just a heads up, in about a month, December 14th, we will have our Sustainable Seafood Digital Event. This is going to be a really exciting one. We're going to dive into a load of different topics, including sustainable financing. We're going to be speaking with some of the experts in the financial community, investors, folks like DNB, AquaSpark, Faird, Biomar. We're going to have a fantastic lineup of folks to talk about these issues. You don't want to miss it. So you can go to intrafishevents.com. Registration is open. Registration is also free. So we'd love to have you join us at that event. All right, folks, have a great weekend, and we will speak to you next week.